Healthcare is confusing. We know it. And if we have questions, I'm sure you do, too.
Whatever happened, why would, how much they...
What is he going to...
Why or why not? Who's benefiting?
What exactly?
Where will they come from?
Why? How many more...
Who is...
What's going on?
So don't ask me no questions, and I won't tell you no lies.
Healthcare reform passed in the Senate Finance Committee yesterday. Do you know what's in the bill? Are no stupid questions today, and the only place we'll send you is to the phone on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 14th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for a few days, so I'm on my own. Coming up this hour, it's a monster. We're going to talk about the $829 billion healthcare reform bill that passed the Senate Finance Committee and what that means in terms of actual reform. Also, Hillary Clinton wrapping up her trip to Russia. We'll talk about what she did or did not accomplish there. But first, David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. So, David, this bill that came out of the Senate Finance Committee, what percentage of this bill is actually going to end up in the bill on President Obama's desk?
I'm going to say 92%.
Really?
This is 92% of the bill that you're going to see.
And are you going to give us an armchair quarterback chance and it going, passing both the...
to get to the president's desk, it's got to pass the Senate. You know, it's got to get 60 votes to beat a Republican filibuster. They can't make a whole lot of changes. And I think the big thing you're going to see is that, look at the price tag. President Obama has said his plan will cost around $900 billion. This is an $829 billion. It's paid for, of course, over the 10 years, but $829 billion is about 92% of that $900 billion number. I think you will see the other 8% filled out. There's your bill.
David Herzenhorn, we're going to get back to you in just a few minutes, but right now, everything else that you need to know this morning. In the headlines, as David mentioned, the Senate begins the process of merging two different versions of the health care bill. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid kicks off talks in his office today. He says he wants that merged bill on the Senate floor in the next 2 weeks. New data out from the CDC shows that nearly half of all people hospitalized due to H1N1 or swine flu had no underlying medical conditions. That means the virus can be serious, even in those who are basically healthy. Automaker Ford is recalling an additional 4.5 million vehicles equipped with cruise control switches. They've been known to short circuit and cause fires. And the president is holding another meeting with his national security team today to discuss Afghanistan. He said yesterday a decision on troops will be made in the coming weeks. Some new economic data expected out later this hour. Retail sales from last month. We'll get you those numbers as soon as we have them. Wall Street mostly flat yesterday. The Dow is going to kick off at 98.71. The S&P starts trade at 1073, and the NASDAQ is going to open up at 2140. So as you heard, we're interested in your questions and concerns about health care reform. What do you still not understand in the bill? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. So it was no surprise, but it's still significant. The Senate Finance Committee passed their $829 billion 10-year health care plan, and it is a major victory for the Obama administration. And as a nation, this is the closest we have been to any kind of health care reform for decades. Still, lots of Americans have questions. That's no surprise. This is from Takeaway listener Omna from New Jersey.
My name is Amna. I'm calling from New Jersey. I'm still quite angry that a public option was not included in the Baucus bill. I do hope it's included in the final bill, although I'm not sure exactly how that's going to be at this point. In all honesty, if public option is not included in the final bill, I don't think it should be called or even considered health care reform.
So for all of your questions, we have a couple guys ready to answer them. We've got Henry Aaron. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Good morning. And also David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, rejoins us. So let's start with the public option, because I imagine that's the question of a lot of Americans this morning. It's not in the Max Baucus bill that passed out of the Senate Finance Committee. But David, what are the chances that we're going to see some form of public option in the final bill that goes to President Obama?
They're pretty good. The question is, how do you define a public option? The House, the Democrats in the House seem intent on passing their bill with a public option in it. Obviously, Senate Democrats are divided. And, you know, my guess is that what you'll see is some sort of compromise, maybe along the lines of what Olympia Snow, the one Republican on the Finance Committee who voted for the bill yesterday, has proposed, which is basically letting a public option be triggered in any state where there, you know, not enough people can still can afford insurance after this bill becomes law.
So, Henry Aaron, you're a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. As I mentioned earlier, there's lots of versions of this bill. It's not just the Baucus bill. There's another one that came out of another Senate committee, and then there's three bills that came out of three separate House committees. So give me civics 101 here. What happens to the health care reform now?
Well, the true answer is God only knows. The first step is that the two Senate bills have to be combined, and then there will be a floor debate, amendments, and a vote within the Senate. The question is whether the product can command 60 votes, which would require the Democrats to stay almost completely united, assuming that Olympia Snowes continues to support the bill. Whether she would, if there was any variety of a public option other than the one that David just outlined, is doubtful, which would mean the Democrats have to stay united. Then the House will blend the three really quite similar bills that have passed different House committees. That will be comparatively easy, in my judgment. The Democrats have a quite large majority, and that bill will be, in many respects, more liberal than the Senate bill, probably a bit larger. Certainly, it will include a public option. The way it's paid for will probably be different from the Senate bill. Then comes the next real big hurdle, and I think it's a huge hurdle. The two houses have to conference and agree, members of each house have to agree on how to blend those two bills. At that point, that's going to be a major challenge because, for example, the House Democrats don't like the way the Senate proposes to pay for the bill, and the senators don't like the way the House has proposed to pay for it. So getting an agreement is going to be hard. Next, that has to go back to each House to be passed. And once again, the big question then would be whether the bill could pass the Senate. So I think the chances of final legislation are far from sure. As David said, this is certainly the best opportunity we've had in living memory, but it's not something you want to bet your child's college tuition on.
So, David, take a listen to this question. It's from Barbara from Oklahoma.
My husband has knee infection. He has MRSA. I think we're talking about trying to look at some ways to save some money on Medicare. Now, don't mistake, I am thankful we have Medicare because it would have been extremely difficult for us to take care of his medicine and everything. But I think the amount of extra money they spend could be spent on helping some other people.
So that's Barbara willing to give up a little bit of her Medicare money. Was there anything in the Senate Finance Committee that dealt with Medicare?
There's tons, and actually, you know, it sounds like what she's afraid of is that Medicare is going to be cut, and this is like the public option. You know, it's one of these things that nobody fully understands, right? The logic here is that Medicare spending is growing way out of control, right? If you consider the fact that as a country we spend $500 billion a year on Medicare right now to cover 45 million people, the health care bill that Congress is talking about would spend about $90 billion a year to cover, you know, somewhere in the range of 30 million people. So there's tons of spending on Medicare. What the experts tell us is that, in fact, there's less spending on Medicare for the same type of person with the same type of medical needs in different parts of the country. And if you ask the person in Oklahoma with the knee problem, you know, do you realize that the same treatment that you're getting here is costing, you know, the government 75% of what it's costing, you know, in Georgia, say, or Florida? They'd probably say, no, had no idea, right? It's a question of figuring out how to get, you know, efficiencies in the large amount of spending that's going on now. So there's a ton in this bill about Medicare, and something has to be done about Medicare one way or another, because of the main trust fund that pays for it, all the experts say, is going broke.
Okay, so it sounds to me like the Senate Finance Committee, the passing of this particular bill, didn't answer a lot of our questions about health care. But here's another one. This is from another one of our listeners.
This is Steve in Massachusetts. Whatever happened to the idea of letting insurance companies sell across state lines? It seems like a no-brainer for creating competition.
Henry, what's the answer to that question?
The answer to that is that there are grave questions about what the impact of that kind of a change would be. The reason is that what insurance companies are allowed to call an acceptable insurance policy is defined in state legislatures, which have been rather prone to lobbying. And there is a concern that particular states would find it in their financial interest to write the requirements so low that insurance companies would flock to their states and then sell in the rest of the United States. So there's been a lot of resistance to that, unless the federal government, through legislation, writes national standards that insurance companies would have to meet in order to sell at all.
And Henry, this bill does that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, here's a question: as we're seeing all of these new ads that the insurance companies have put on, saying that this is going to raise the premiums for everybody else in the country who already has insurance. From what I understand from the bill that got passed yesterday in the Senate Finance Committee, for somebody like me who has insurance through my work, I can keep that. I'm not going to see any changes, right?
Let me back up a step. I believe the current bill authorizes in some cases, the state exchanges to define what is an acceptable policy, and that could be a risky outcome. The idea here, yes, is that people should be able to keep their own insurance. I would think the vast majority of people would see no change at all if this legislation passes, because they would continue to be insured through their place of employment, and the employer would retain the policy that they've previously had. In some situations, the employers might choose to suspend their insurance policy and pay a penalty that the bill imposes on them. But for the great majority of Americans who are insured through work, I think things would be pretty much as they are.
Okay, so David, with this, the insurance company saying the premiums are going to go sky high, what's the truth to that? If this bill passes, my insurance is probably not going to change, most likely, but is my premium that gets taken out of my paycheck every week, is that going to go up?
There's no question it's going to go up, but not necessarily because of this legislation. The federal government, for instance, announced just a week or so ago that premiums for federal government employees are going to go up an average of 8.8% next year, and for the most popular Blue Cross national plan, it'll be up 15% for individuals and 12% for families, right? So we know where prices of premiums are going if there's no law. What we don't know is, you know, how fast that increase will continue. The supporters of this bill say, you know, there's stuff in here that could actually slow that growth pretty fast. The Congressional Budget Office, who we trust to do all the analyzing and count up all the beans here, says, you know what, we just can't really tell you for sure, because there's so many variations in, you know, each individual person's circumstance.
So it sounds, David, like the takeaway here is that we have lots of questions to which we don't have definitive answers, and we're not going to know the answers for a long time. David Herzenhorn is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. He also spoke with Henry Aaron, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Keep your questions coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We'll do our best to answer them.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following all this week. We're going to go to Washington first. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, is out this week. So Julie Mason, our friend and White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, is here to answer the tough questions about the Senate Finance Committee passed yesterday. So, Julie, President Obama and his administration is probably very thrilled about the fact that this got out of committee, but not everybody is happy. Who is the most upset about what came out of the Senate Finance Committee?
There are a lot of upset parties, I will say that. Well, one group that's really upset, it's the unions. They don't like what they saw in the Senate. Senate version of the health care bill doesn't include a public option, and that's something that the unions were really pushing for. So they were a little circumspect in their joy yesterday when President Obama was in the Rose Garden extolling the greatness of the Senate Finance Committee action.
Are the unions going to be happy with anything less than a robust public option?
No, they're really not. You know, they've been very organized and a very strong voice on this.
Well, they're unions.
Yeah,
they're organized,
it's true.
Labor.
Exactly. But they, you know, their role has been somewhat submerged. It hasn't been really out front. The problem is that Obama has no compunction at all about thumbing his nose at these traditional Democratic constituencies. And we've seen that in other issues, gay rights and the environment. He just, you know, the White House feels like this is a time to be pragmatic, and they don't really have a lot of time to mollify liberal constituencies. So the unions may not get what they want from the White House.
Who does he have to mollify then to get this out of the both?
The middle. He needs to mollify the middle. Those Blue Dog Democrats are still very, very tetchy about this whole thing. They are concerned about how to pay for it, which is still an issue that's unresolved, and also what it's going to look like. So keeping his own party together is going to be tough for the president as his process sort of rolls on.
So we heard Senator Orrin Hatch talking about how the Democrats aren't going to be happy unless they get a single-payer option. It seemed to me like first of all, single payer is in none of the bills that made it out of committees. Are the Republicans still focusing on the single payer issue?
Republicans are all over the place. Single payer has become sort of like a dirty phrase to throw out there to get everyone all fired up. No, like you say, no one's talking about single payer. That's not even on the table.
Okay, I guess we're going to keep watching this as it moves through. All five bills move through the Senate and the House. Thanks so much, Julie Mason, sure. White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. And now to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. So yesterday we heard some very surprising news from the Supreme Court. I assume that you were surprised. They've agreed to hear an appeal from Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling about his fraud case. Do we have any idea why they just decided to do that?
Well, Celeste, he's arguing that he did not get a fair trial. And if you look at some of the coverage back when we were all talking about Enron, remember that's the company that shifted money all around and hid it from shareholders. It was an energy company. If you look at the coverage from back then, you had things like the Houston Chronicle saying, "Your tar and feathers ready? Mine are." You even had a rap song, "Drop the S off Skilling." So there definitely was a lot of negative coverage. He's been saying that he had an unfair trial in the Houston area because of it. And in fact, on appeal, he's already gotten some judges to agree that he did have an unfair trial, and they're reducing his 24-year sentence. They haven't decided what they're reducing it to. So he's arguing that, and he's also arguing about the meaning of the law he was convicted under. It's kind of technical with that, but the Supreme Court will be weighing this particular law that says it's a crime to deprive another of the intangible right of honest service. So they'll be evaluating that.
Okay. Well, there's news on another big story, the current big legal case, a.k.a. scandal in the financial industry, and that has to do with Bank of America. They have a whole bunch of lawsuits from shareholders, and there's some regulatory investigations, but you found some juiciness in this story. What have you turned up here?
So Bank of America is turning over all kinds of documents now to Congress and to the Attorney General of New York that they had tried to keep secret. And I got my hands on some of the first ones coming out. And these are pretty juicy. This is an email exchange in January, right before Bank of America got another bailout, in which we've got two board members emailing each other during a board meeting about what they think of this second bailout and what they think about Bank of America's situation. And let me just tell you how some of this email chatter goes between these two directors, Tom May and Chad Gifford. Remember, Chad Gifford used to be CEO of Fleet. He's
right.
Pretty famous. And so Tom says, wow, to Chad, and Chad says, concentrate on the phone. And Tom says, screw you. Chad says, unfortunately, it's screw the shareholders.
Oh.
Tom reminds him, no trail. And Chad comes back, only stated in the context of a horrible economy will affect everyone. Tom comes back, good comeback, holy beep on the people. Amazing, says Chad. So this is the kind of dirty laundry that we're going to be seeing as more of these secret documents come out. And so it promises an interesting story over the next few weeks.
When will people learn that if they're going to screw the shareholders, they can't put it in email?
Don't go in Gmail. Don't go in your email.
Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times. And as always, our final takeout comes from you, the listeners. We asked you for your stories about our conversation on how age affects job prospects. We spoke a lot about how hard it is for younger folks to get hired in this economy. And we heard at 8778MYTAKE about older people as well. Here's Paul from Pontiac, Michigan.
Hello, my name's Paul, and I'm calling about the job search age thing. And I'm 54, and I've been searching for a job for 14 months, and I believe my age is a deterrent.
We heard much the same thing from Bill.
Good morning. My name is Bill. I'm a 61-year-old registered nurse. Told I have an excellent resume, but it never gets past the first phone call. Got wiped out by medical bills, so I need to keep working. I'm just not getting the offers.
And a younger listener, Devin, called to tell us how his situation affects older people.
Hi, this is Desmond from Detroit. I work in the social work field, and actually I replace someone significantly older than me, but apparently in my field, people tend to get burnt out quickly, so I apparently am doing circles around her for less money.
Don emails us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is his reason why. He says, my wife and I are both laid off. We have roughly 50 years between us of continuous retail experience. Can't find any work to cover our bills. I get the distinct feeling that many employers don't believe I will stay with them once they hire me when something better comes along. I always felt my experience was an asset. So far, it seems to be a liability. And Carol emails us, I have 6 kids ages 17 to 32, and they have families they're trying to support, taking entry-level jobs closer to home or not able to get work at all. They can't get adequate employment because of their age and experience. It's a horrible catch-22. My kids doubled up in houses because they can't afford to live on their own. So we have families meshing together, sharing expenses, and still struggling to get by. Lots of personal stories about that statistic about younger people having a hard time finding work. When you hear a statistic that rings a bell in your personal life, you know who to call. Us, 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about Hillary Clinton's trip to Moscow and whether or not that reaped results.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Coming up in a few minutes, not a lot of Lyubov coming out for Hillary Clinton in Moscow. That's the Russian word for love. We're going to talk about whether or not she failed in her mission in just a few minutes. But first, Mark Garrison has some of the news stories that we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. A key economic indicator is just out about a minute and a half ago. Retail sales are down 1.5%. That's the biggest decline in 9 months. But it's actually a little bit better, even though it's a big drop, a little bit better than what analysts were expecting, because they knew, because cash for clunkers was winding down, that auto sales were going to be going down. So we'll watch that and analyze that throughout the morning. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid is the man to watch today. High-level Democrats are meeting with him. They're trying to get competing health care bills to match. Reid wants a bill on the Senate floor by the week after next. Staying with health care, there's a new study out raising questions about who's in danger from H1N1 or swine flu. The CDC report shows nearly half of patients hospitalized for the virus did not have a chronic health condition. In California, there are fears up and down that state that heavy rains and snow could trigger landslides. Southern California resident Steve Brown put up sandbags to protect his home.
Kind of wondering if we were so lucky having our house safe from the fire, you know, because this is another round of slow torture.
Slow torture in those areas that were scorched by recent wildfires. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So political pundits are all over Hillary Clinton's trip to Russia. Many of them are saying that she was ineffective during her trip there and even failed because her Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, announced that his country is not supporting harsh sanctions against Iran. And that's one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton went to Russia. So joining us to talk about her trip to Russia and whether or not it was a failure is Will Inbeden. He's a former Bush administration National Security Council staff member. He's currently at the Legatum Institute in London. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Celeste.
So we have heard that she went to Russia for several things. Number one was to talk about sanctions against Iran. And then we got an announcement from Sergei Lavrov saying that Russia does not support harsh sanctions against Iran. Was that a failure on Hillary Clinton's part?
I wouldn't so much pin it as a failure on her part as rather say it may be an emerging failure of the broader Obama administration policy framework with Russia and Iran. And she's kind of working within, a fairly flawed structure there of essentially the Obama administration made a very big concession to the Russians on the third site missile defense in the Czech Republic and Poland, but doesn't seem to have gotten a solid guarantee from the Russians up front that the Russians would in turn support more robust sanctions on Iran. Rather, we had some artfully worded passive voice statements from Medvedev saying, well, sanctions may eventually occur, but didn't show much support there. So that then gives Lavrov and presumably Putin, who's been suspiciously silent on this, an end to come out and, you know, embarrass the administration and Secretary Clinton by saying that they they don't support sanctions at this particular juncture. So, again, I wouldn't pin the blame on Secretary Clinton herself. It's still a lot of moving parts, and we'll see how it plays out. But I think she's working within a difficult policy framework that was flawed earlier on.
Well, we spoke with Masha Lipman yesterday. She is from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Moscow. And this is what she said about Hillary Clinton.
I think that she, of course, is associated with her husband, and the presidency of Bill Clinton is not regarded in Russia as a time when the relations were good. Also, that was the time of the presidency of President Yeltsin in Russia, who too is regarded as a figure who did more harm to Russia than good. So this makes her a person from those days.
Is she handicapped already because of her past history?
I don't, with all due respect to Masha, I don't think that would be the strongest factor there, that this is the politics of personality going back to her husband and the previous Clinton administration. Rather, what's more going on is the Russians will act in their national interests, and as most great powers do, and it's just kind of Russia's calculated assessment, I think, that it's not in their national interest to support stronger sanctions on Iran. I mean, keep in mind with the personality issues, it can go both ways. For example, former President Bush and Putin early on in their relationship seemed to have pretty strong and positive personal chemistry. But I, as we saw in the Bush administration, that personal chemistry over time did not translate into a lot of, solid, progress with the U.S.-Russia relationship overall. So likewise with some of the friction between, President Clinton and the bad memories of the Yeltsin administration in Russia, I don't think that some of that baggage would be fairly hung on Secretary Clinton.
So, Will Inbedin, we have been hearing a lot, especially from the far right, that President Obama, in their words, kowtowed to Russia by changing their opinions on the missile defense shield in September, and now Russia has embarrassed the Obama administration by not supporting him in foreign policy against Iran. Is this, in your view, all of this talk about Hillary Clinton failing in Russia, is this just more of the attacks against Obama? Is just another chance to say that President Obama is failing, or is there some kind of substance?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't defend, extra inflammatory rhetoric or anything in some of the attacks. But at the same time, I think there is a very real policy concern here on the substance. I was just in in Prague last week and met with a number of Czech government officials. And, privately, it's very safe to say that there's real sense of betrayal and outrage and mistrust among the Czech Republic. And there were some Polish officials there as well who voice similar sentiments. And so it's not just, domestic criticisms of Obama from right-wing Americans, but these are some very real concerns among our very strong Central and Eastern European allies. And again, coming back to great power calculations, we have to ask, what did the United States, what did the international community gain by this reversal on the missile defense systems? If there had been a solid, concrete policy gain that we got from the Russians, then there might be a better defense for the policy. But I think the fact that it really alienated some of our important allies in Central and Eastern Europe, but likewise doesn't seem to have resulted in any policy improvements from the Russians, especially vis-a-vis Iranian sanctions. But rather, Lavrov, who is a difficult character, seems to be went out of his way to almost publicly embarrass the U.S. and the Obama administration.
But they did agree to allow to provide some support routes and things for the war in Afghanistan, and that's a relatively major reversal for the Russian government. Is that not enough?
Well, again, that I don't want to downplay that at all, but that's also something that's in Russia's interest and that they had been doing for a number of years before they started trying to curtail it just to gain leverage over the U.S. And so, in some ways, we're just back to the position we should have been. And also, it's in Russia's interest to have a stable, secure Afghanistan on their southern border there. So, we can applaud that as a positive, but certainly not. Sort of a commensurate trade-off with the change of course on missile defense.
So in a one-word answer, does the Obama administration need to get some sort of concession from Russia soon?
Yes.
We just heard from Will Inmaden, former Bush administration National Security Council staff member. He's currently with Legatum Institute in London. He joined us from Bush House in London, England. Thanks so much to him. And we're going to be talking about mushrooms, the edible and legal kind, in just a few minutes. And we'll tell you how you can forage for your own. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is away for a few days. So Hillary Clinton is not the only news coming out of Russia this week. The U.S. Secretary of State was meeting with her Russian counterpart. But meanwhile, hundreds of people from Russia's criminal element were attending the funeral of Russia's most infamous mafia chief, Vyacheslav Ivankov. He was not just notorious in Russia, though, or we probably wouldn't be talking about him. He's known as the godfather of the Russian mafia here in the United States. Here he is talking in 2005 after being acquitted of a double murder in Moscow. He called it a day of celebration.
Дело не в планах, это моя личная жизнь. А дело-то в другом. Я вернулся к себе на отчизну, и для меня это
So that's Ivankov saying, this is my private life. The important thing is I'm back in the fatherland, and this is a great event, a great day of celebration for me. So to talk about Ivankov and his role, not just in Russian mafia, but the United States, BBC Russia analyst Stephen Eat. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Well, he's a remarkable character. Mr. Ivankov was better known as Yaponchik, or the little Japanese. That was a reference to his appearance. He had vaguely Asiatic features and a great love of Japanese martial arts, and a career criminal starting back in the late 1960s when the Soviet Union collapsed. He moved to the United States, where he was eventually convicted for extortion among the very large Russian immigrant community in Brooklyn. He returned to Russia after serving his jail sentence in the United States and went back to his old ways in the Russian criminal underworld. He was actually acknowledged to be one of the top mafia chiefs, a godfather, if you like, of the Russian mafia. And at the funeral in Moscow, which took place on Tuesday, at one of the most prestigious cemeteries, it has to be said, in Moscow, where Russian sportsmen, various cultural figures, writers, filmmakers are buried, there were a vast number of people from the criminal underworld. The Russian police say something like 500 people turned up, not just from the criminal underworld in Russia, but also the former Soviet republics and other countries. What I think is particularly remarkable is that although many of those people were known to be either criminal from the criminal fraternity or members of mafia-style groups, the Russian police stood guarding them, ensuring that journalists couldn't get anywhere near.
So he actually shot by a sniper back in July when he was leaving a restaurant.
Indeed, he was leaving a Thai restaurant, one of the most expensive Thai restaurants in Moscow. He was shot, three bullets hit him in the stomach. Russian surgeons tried to save his life, but he eventually died from complications resulting from his wounds. Very interestingly, at the funeral, which took place on Tuesday, if you looked at the inscriptions on the wreaths, the sympathy messages, they were all from various so-called brotherhoods. So absolutely no doubt at all about what sort of structures this man represented. The Russian mafia has never really gone away. It's polished up its act. It doesn't act in an overtly brutal way that we saw, at the beginning of the 1990s, but it's very strongly represented, particularly in gambling and also in the construction industries. And interestingly, on the internet over the past few days, an open letter has appeared signed by 36 Russian mafia chiefs, and they're calling for the execution of another mafia chief they consider responsible for Mr. Ivankov's death.
Just in case this entire story didn't represent something out of The Godfather enough, we have a letter saying that they want to kill the person who killed Ivankov. BBC Russia analyst Stephen Eag joined us from the Bush House in London.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley. Coming up, where the wild things are, there are mushrooms, and some of them are delicious. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. We're also taking your questions about the health care bill. Do you understand where health care reform stands now, where it's going, and how it's going to affect you and your insurance policy if you have one? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, let's check on the leading stories with Mark Gennison at 32 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. On that health care you just mentioned, there's more movement today. The Senate begins combining two different overhaul bills. Lots of backroom dealing will unfold. Democrats want a bill on the Senate floor by the week after next. In economic news, a report out just this hour shows retail sales down 1.5%. It's the biggest decline since late last year. Bad as it may sound, forecasters actually thought it would be worse. A post-cash for clunkers drop in car sales is a big factor in the new numbers. Oil is at a year high. Prices topped $75 a barrel. Part of the spike is the weak dollar, which you've certainly felt if you've traveled abroad lately. And looking ahead, President Obama meets with his national security team to talk strategy in Afghanistan today. He's considering a request from top commander over there, General Stanley McChrystal, for many more troops. The president says he'll decide in the coming weeks, and those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So yesterday, the military announced it met all of its annual recruiting goals. That's pretty big news. It's the first time it's done that in more than 35 years, ever since the military became an all-volunteer force. Why has that happened? Glenn Altshuler, a friend of The Takeaway, is going to help us answer that question. He's professor of American Studies at Cornell University and author of the book, The GI Bill, The New Deal for Veterans. So, Glenn, they've met their annual recruiting goals for the first time in 35 years. How come?
Well, Celeste, I think it's pretty clear that the economic crisis is the principal driver of the success of the armed services in this endeavor. When you've got unemployment, real unemployment, that's approaching 16% if you include discouraged workers, you've got a pool of people to draw on, and Army recruiters have reached them.
And does this make change the debate over whether or not we send more troops overseas to Afghanistan?
I honestly don't think so. I think that overall force levels are important. There will be a decline in the number of troops in Iraq over time. Some of those men and women will shift to Afghanistan. The real question for the armed forces is whether this recruitment success can be sustained over the next months and years, and whether the need of our armed forces to be deployed in many theaters is going to remain the same, increase or decline over those years. That will cause stress for the armed services, not in the near term.
What about all these servicemen that we're hearing reports of people serving very lengthy tours overseas or coming back from Iraq, getting to spend a month with their families and immediately getting sent back to Afghanistan maybe? Is this going to end if we have enough people in the military to cover those spots?
I don't think that will end in the near term because the increase in the armed forces in meeting the recruitment targets is not that great. And as I say, a year from now, 2 years from now, that's unsustainable. You can't keep sending people back two and three times. That'll be a political issue, and it will be a man and woman power issue for the armed services. But that can be sustained for a bit longer.
And of course, as you say, the takeaway question here is, once the economy improves, can we really expect to see that many recruits?
And I'm not sure we can.
Glenn Altshuler is a professor of American Studies at Cornell University, author of The GI Bill, The New Deal for Veterans.
All you can eat.
It's Wednesday, and every Wednesday we talk about food on The Takeaway. This week, we're encouraging you to get out of your kitchen. That is the sound of tramping through autumn leaves in the forest. You're hearing that because our Takeaway contributor, Kathy Gunst, actually got outside and tramped through the forest looking for wild mushrooms. We also have Rob Evans here with us. He's the chef at Hugo's Restaurant in Portland, Maine, and winner of the 2009 James Beard Award. So, Kathy, let's start with you. Why go foraging through the woods for mushrooms? What's the appeal?
There's nothing more wild and fresh than going into the woods and picking a wild mushroom.
So you went with a professional forager named Rick Tibbetts. Here's Tibbetts talking about a surprising flavor you can get in the spring.
You start to find what's called a pheasantback mushroom. Pheasantback mushroom is a mushroom that smells and tastes like watermelon, unsweetened watermelon, the flavor. And then we come into July. In the mid of July, you start to see black trumpets and chanterelles and like a two-colored bilite.
Why do you need a professional to go with you for mushroom hunting?
You have to know what you're doing. Rick Tibbetts has been studying mushrooms for 30 years. You know, one of the leading mycologists in the world in Germany several years ago dropped dead, so you can't know.
A mycologist, I should say, is somebody who studies fungus, which would
Correct.
Include mushrooms. Rob Evans, you're the winner of the James Beard Award and a chef at Hugo's. You made a matsutake risotto at your restaurant with the mushrooms that you'd actually foraged. The recipe is actually on our website if our listeners are interested. You can make this recipe even if you don't go out mushroom hunting, right?
You could. You could substitute dried and fresh shiitake mushrooms if you needed to.
What does a matsutake mushroom taste like?
It's really unique. I think it's one of my favorites. It's got this real woodsy aroma, really deep, almost like a Maine truffle, I guess.
And are they the same sort of consistency as a truffle?
They're tight and they're dry. They're not that firm. Like a truffle at all.
Kathy, have you tried the matsutake mushrooms?
I did. You know, I just wanted to say that we went out to the woods in northwestern Maine last Saturday, and I brought some of the matsutakes home, and Rob said to me, they taste a little bit like pasta, and I didn't know what he was talking about. But I went home, and I thinly sliced them, got a skillet really hot with olive oil and garlic and a little rosemary, threw the mushrooms in, took them out, and grated some Parmesan cheese on them, and my God, he was absolutely right. It was like eating a very tender but complexly interesting fresh pasta. Really, really interesting.
I want to reemphasize here that you're neither of you, neither Kathy nor Rob, is suggesting people go out into the woods near them and pick up mushrooms and take them home and cook them. Here's Rick Tibbetts talking about how he makes sure his mushrooms that he picks are edible.
I make sure that everything is edible. I eat everything I harvest. There's a lot of people that are going out there now with a book in their hand, driving around, picking up stuff, and then matching it in the book, and going to the door restaurant saying, I'm a professional forager, and here's what I got. And they're like 50% sure. Just last year alone, there was 3 different poisonings because of this happening.
So, Kathy, is it possible for people to go hunting for mushrooms and still feel safe?
Well, I would really recommend that you go out with a so-called professional. Just in the state of Maine, they're about to have licensed mediators, people that all wild foragers will have to bring their mushrooms to. These will be insured, licensed people.
And Rob, what mushrooms would you suggest if someone wanted to try a different kind of mushroom than what they were used to in their own kitchen? What should they start with?
Maybe a chanterelle. I think chanterelles, they stand out. They get the most unique flavor, and they're pretty common around the country.
What's a chanterelle like? What does it taste like?
It's an orange mushroom, and it's really hard, I find, with mushrooms. A lot of people ask that question to compare them to something else.
Rob, don't you think they're kind of buttery? They have a really kind of a silky quality on the tongue.
They do. Yep, texture is definitely unique on a chanterelle compared to a lot of other mushrooms.
Kathy, what about you? What are your suggestions for people who are feeling adventurous with their mushrooms? What should they try?
Well, one of the things I love to do is go to a farmer's market, get a variety of wild mushrooms, and I roast them in about a 400-degree oven, a little bit of olive oil. And then as soon as I take the pan out, while it's super hot, I deglaze it with some vegetable stock or a chicken stock, and I throw it into a food processor, and you have a really complex roasted mushroom soup that's 2 steps, about 30 minutes, incredibly easy, but really perfect eating for fall when a lot of parts of the the country are just starting to get cold, and we crave these more complex, earthy flavors.
Kathy Gunst, food writer and takeaway contributor, joined us from Maine. We are also joined by Rob Evans, chef at Hugo's Restaurant in Portland and winner of the 2009 James Beard Award. You can go to thetakeaway.org for those recipes. You're going to find the Rob's Matsutake Risotto recipe and the wild mushroom soup that Kathy was just talking about there. You can also go to that website just to respond to anything that you've heard on The Takeaway. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The healthcare bill is moving through Congress, and there are a lot of questions.
We know where prices of premiums are going if there's no law. What we don't know is, you know, how fast that increase will continue.
That's The Takeaway from New York Times' David Herzenhorn. What's your question? Do you still need to know something about the process? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE. And if you've missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Go to take our podcast at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. The number of women serving in the military has risen over the years, but so have the reports of sexual assault.
I think as long as men and women walk this earth and we both serve in boots, it's going to happen, period.
165 sexual assaults reported in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2008, and that's not counting those that go unreported.
Be careful how you bend me. Be careful where you send.
How can we protect our women in uniform? We'll answer that carefully on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 14th. I'm Celeste Headlee, alone today because John Hockenberry is still out for a couple days. Coming up at this hour, we're going to continue a conversation from yesterday about women in the military and how we might protect them from things that may happen that are not so pleasant. Also, 4 years after Katrina, it looks like the schools in New Orleans are doing better than ever. Why is that? And a 30-year anniversary of Rapper's Delight. We'll ask some hip-hop heroes where they were when it topped the charts. But first, our Army Sergeant Kara Hammer, Iraq war veteran working in veteran support for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. So this new report shows sexual assault in the military was up 9% last year. So Sergeant Hammer, when a female soldier is serving in the field, how much does she have to stay aware of sexual assault issues and deal with them on a daily basis?
Well, I think that it's something that should be in the forefront of every woman's mind. And, you know, when you're walking to the shower tents, you're walking to the bathroom, you're walking down a dirt road with your battle buddy. It's something that needs to always be on your mind, and you need to be aware of your surroundings, who you're with, and that there's always that potential for those hazards.
Sergeant Kara Hammer, stay with us. We're going to talk with you more in just a minute. But first, everything else that you need to know this morning. In the headlines, lawmakers gather today in the office of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. They're kicking off the process of combining two versions of the health care bill into one. Reid says he wants the merged bill on the Senate floor in the next 2 weeks, and we know how great legislators are at meeting deadlines. President Obama meets today with his national security team about Afghanistan. He said yesterday he hasn't made up his mind about troops yet.
I would expect that we will have a completion of this current process in the coming weeks.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced the U.S. military has met its recruitment goal this year. It's the first time that's happened since the military became an all-volunteer force in 1973. And in economic news, retail sales dropped 1.5% last month. It's the biggest decline in 9 months, due chiefly to a drop in auto sales after the Cash for Clunkers program. Wall Street mostly flat yesterday. The Dow is going to kick off at 98.71, and the S&P starts trading at 10.73. The NASDAQ will open up at 21.40. So Max Bach, his health care bill is now out of the Senate Finance Committee and into the full Senate. Do you still have questions about health care reform? I do. I bet you do as well. Are you still confused about some issues, or are there some things you're concerned about? Let us know. 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. We're going to continue a conversation that we started yesterday about the increasing roles of women in the military, whether they have the same opportunities, and how do they fare when they're actually serving. A new report shows sexual assault in the military was up 9% last year, and that a lot of the assaults actually go unreported still. The report also shows that the VA health system isn't set up always to care for women, and it may be harder for women to rise through the ranks. The author of that report is Erin Mulhall. She's Deputy Policy Director of Research with the organization Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. We're also rejoined by Army Sergeant Kara Hammer. She served in Iraq from 2004 to 2005 and works in veteran services at the IAVA. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Erin, the report that you authored says there's a 9% rise in sexual assaults in the military last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
It also says that many of these are going unreported. But one of the responses from the Pentagon was that part of this rise is due to an increasing number of reports of sexual assault. How do you reconcile those two things?
Sure. Well, the Department of Defense really just began to put in an adequate tracking system in recent years. So we really don't know the true extent, the scope of sexual assaults in the military, because we haven't had this consistent reporting requirements year after year. One of the things they stress is that the fact that the rates have risen in the last year is due to reporting, which is great. We encourage more female victims to come forward and report this crime so that action can be taken against their victim. At the same time, you know, we're still seeing that half of all sexual assaults are going unreported, and we need to expand, we need to increase the ability of more women to come forward and report this crime.
Well, the Department of Defense, in their response to your report, it points to a policy that they started in June of 2005 in which they allow soldiers, female soldiers, to report sexual assault without giving their own name or their attacker's name. Why hasn't that fixed the under-reporting problem?
Sure. Well, still, I mean, even with the reporting, restricted reporting, actual anonymity is, you know, it's next to impossible to guarantee. You still have to report rank and gender and age, and especially in deployed environments when you're working in such a close-knit community. I mean, it's possible that that information could come out. At the same time, you know, other women are fearful that if they were to report it, that they might be moved from within their unit, and they don't necessarily want the repercussions to happen against them rather than against their attacker. Trauma itself is very difficult to report, especially in the military when you're serving alongside your attacker. And, you know, it takes a lot for a woman to come forward and report the crime. And even if there are extra assurances, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the victims feel comfortable enough to report these crimes until they leave the military, which is why, you know, we're seeing that women are turning to the VA for counseling, but after they leave the military.
Kara,
after they lose the action taken against the attacker.
Kara, you served for 5 years of active duty, and you were in Iraq as well. Did you know any female soldiers who'd been assaulted?
I did, in fact. I was lucky enough to not have those experiences myself, but I did serve with one specific female that I know underwent some assault from a coworker of hers, in fact.
Did she report it?
She did not. She did not.
Why not?
There was an instance, and, you know, I don't know the full details of it. That was her choice. She chose not to, whether she was protecting her counterpart. She actually made up a story to protect him.
I made up a story for her injuries? To explain
for her injuries, yep. She was assaulted by her counterpart and then was told the command that she fell.
This is getting into sensitive territory, but if you were in your friend's place, would you have felt safe enough against repercussions to have reported it yourself?
I feel like I would have, I guess mainly because I wouldn't take those repercussions would be worth it, I guess, to me. And, you know, to some, it's not. People want to make a career out of this. And you're told that, you know, you have the opportunity to tell, but your command is not always supportive like they're supposed to be.
Aaron, you authored this report, and one of the things I found interesting, one of the statistics I found interesting, is that in 2007, only 8% of sexual assailants were referred to courts-martial in the military. Now, that's compared to 40% of offenders in the civilian court system. Why is there a 32% difference in the number of offenders who get referred into the courts?
Sure. Well, courts-martial is actually a very difficult process, and often the evidence isn't there necessarily for a commander to begin the investigative division to begin the process of court-martial, whether it's because, you know, they didn't collect enough evidence at the time of the assaults, or whether, you know, there really isn't enough, you know, other witnesses to the event. So oftentimes commanders in the field pursue administrative action, which is, you know, while they're not convicted of the crime, they do. It's pretty much a career ender for their military career. Unfortunately, I mean, that does little to, you know, convict the assailant of the crime. You know, they're not then added into the sexual assault offenders registry. So, you know, while it may be an ender for your military career, you're still, you know, it's an administrative versus a criminal proceeding.
Okay, Femi Okeh actually went and spoke with New York National Guard Major Lynn Currier yesterday. She has two daughters, twins, 25 years old, and they have also served in Iraq. And this is what she had to say about the sexual assault issue.
There has been one occasion where my daughter did deal with it in Iraq, and I had to actually go to the commanders here in New York. Let's just say had a small conversation and things were taken care of.
So, Kara, it would be great if all women in the military had a mother who was a major and could take care of it for her, but that's certainly not the case. How do we better protect our female soldiers?
Well, I think it starts with training. You know, you fight like you train. So you train, and the importance of, you know, women's issues. And I think that that's a great start, and destigmatize, I guess, all these women's issues and, you know, kind of integrate and, yeah, show the importance of female service.
So maybe all the soldiers, both female and male, are not being trained enough in this issue, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, just across the board. We have an equal opportunity training, and that just kind of depends on who's giving the brief, how seriously that's taken. And maybe they're just, you know, toes need to be held to the fire.
So, Aaron, another thing that your report examines was the healthcare system. And you wrote that it wasn't until 2003 that VA hospitals were even required to meet basic health service for female vets. So has that improved since 2003? It's been 6 years. Are the VA hospitals now providing adequate care to women?
Unfortunately not. I mean, one of the things we're seeing is that, you know, there's a flood of female veterans coming to VA hospitals and clinics. As more women are serving, they're going to be utilizing VA healthcare services in higher numbers. Unfortunately, because the VA has been designed to primarily serve male patients, you know, there's the same level of services there for female veterans that they had, you know, say 10 years ago. I mean, the VA is doing its best to ramp up to meet the surge of female veterans. Unfortunately, they're not doing enough in time. You know, women are experiencing fragmented care. There's not the type of, you know, privacy standards that are being met because VA hospitals don't have the infrastructure in place.
So, Kara, was your experience different? Do you recognize that? Was it easier for you to get adequate care?
No, actually, I think I probably have an experience that's right on track with that. When I came back after a mental health screening, I was told I needed to go see a mental health professional, and I had two options. One was group therapy, and that was, you know, mixed gender. I was going to go with a bunch of OIF men as well as female, and I'm supposed to share my experiences with, you know, people who probably helped and, you know, created my bad experiences. And then the other was to go to first come, first serve, and see a professional privately. And I did that one time, and I went and signed in, sat down, and looked around, and I was sitting with five other male World War II, Vietnam, you know, Korean vets, some missing limbs, and I thought, man, what am I doing here? I have, you know, no business being in the company of these men. So it's hard, I guess, to kind of go through the system, and they make you feel
Out of place.
Out of place, exactly. And then, you know, so you're walking to your health appointment, and you're getting catcalls down the hallway, and, you know, like you're a candy striper coming to pass out cigarettes. So we have got a long way to go. They've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go.
That's Army Sergeant Kara Hammer, Iraq War veteran working in veteran support for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. We also heard from Erin Mulhall, author of a new IAVA report on women in the military.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. We'll start with Washington with our friend Julie Mason. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, filling in this week for Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who's away. And Julie, we've been hearing all morning Max Baucus's bill made it through the Senate Finance Committee. Let's hear what President Obama had to say about it yesterday.
Now's not the time to pat ourselves on the back. Now's not the time to offer ourselves congratulations. Now is the time to dig in and work even harder to get this done.
President Obama was criticized for staying out of the debate up until now. Are we going to see him appearing more in this debate now?
Well, appearing. He's sending Rahm Emanuel, his enigmatic chief of staff, up to Capitol Hill today to knock some heads together and get this thing rolling. Yeah, but Obama is going to be digging in, but it's going to be very backdoor. It's going to be very behind the scenes. We're not going to see the president putting down too many markers on this. He does. They are saying he wants to sign a bill by the end of the year. But I don't think we're going to see him coming out too strong saying specifically what he wants. That's going to be very much behind closed doors.
Is he trying not to draw a line in the sand in case someone steps over it?
Well, that's the thing. The White House wants to preserve the president's political capital. If he declares, I want it thus on such and such in the health care bill, and then he loses, then you and I are going to be talking for weeks about how he got, you know, slammed in Congress and he's not getting what he wants and does he have any power. So they're going to be a little bit circumspect about it, but he does have to take a much more leadership, proactive role in this now.
We've already been talking about health care for weeks, Julie, and it looks like we're going to continue to talk about it for a few weeks. But President Obama says it's not the time to give ourselves congratulations. But the Senate Finance Committee was definitely congratulating itself yesterday. Was this as big of a win as Max Baucus declared?
Well, I do think it's been overplayed a little bit. It's one bill out of one committee. They still have so much work to do. And now comes the really hard part, because now comes really sort of these grinding compromises and sort of behind closed door battles. And that's why, you know, when we talk about President Bush before, you know, we always used to kind of make fun of him for being the decider. But now Obama has to step up and be a bit more of the decider himself.
Okay, Julie Mason is the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Now, for business with Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. So big banks are releasing their earnings report. The first of them, J.P. Morgan, set the standard this morning. What does this report from J.P. Morgan say?
They have a $3.6 billion profit. They're the first of the big banks, Celeste, that are going to report earnings. We're going to see Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. And bank earnings may make some people feel tired and want to go to sleep. But this is pretty important because, remember, with a bunch of these banks, we still have stakes in them. As taxpayers, we own part of them. So how they're doing is important. Plus, I'm going to look in this for a number of indicators about the economy. One thing you can see in these bank earnings is whether the banks are lending more or not, whether they're increasing their loans. You can also look at credit card losses to see how people are falling behind on their bills, as well as mortgage losses to see whether these government modification programs are working. Another thing I'm going to look at is how much pay they're setting aside for bankers and traders. I've been writing since the spring that it looks like it's going to be a record year for bonuses again on Wall Street. We're back to 06, 07 levels. And it kind of seems for a lot of bankers and traders like the financial crisis never happened.
Well, the rest of the country feels that it happened.
They feel it. But, you know, when you look at these numbers, it looks like the big bonus is back.
Are we expecting all of the major banks to be reporting profits?
No. So we don't know yet on all of them, but people are expecting Citigroup to have a loss. People are expecting Bank of America may have a loss. This is driven by their huge portfolios of credit cards and small business loans and loans to consumers. But even though they may have a loss, they are still setting aside a ton of money to pay their investment bankers and traders because the investment bankers and traders are making money and want those big bonuses.
Okay, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times. We know you're going to stay on this story. We'll talk to you more in the days to come. Now for sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And it's time to actually look at what the championship series looks like in baseball. Who's going to be playing?
On Friday, the Angels are going to be coming into the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are coming into New York to play the New York Yankees in the beginning of their series. These teams match up extremely well on paper. Offensively, they're both power-hitting clubs, but I think the edge that the Angels have is their speed. They run the base paths really well, and they're going to really pressure the pitcher of the Yankees to make tough decisions at critical moments. And then in terms of The Yankees pitching actually has the edge in the postseason. They have the lowest ERA of any team in the postseason. Their bullpen has been lights out. So I think it's going to be a good matchup of sort of power ball versus speed ball, what they call small ball, where they take advantage of every opportunity when they get on the base paths.
But who wants it more, Ibrahim?
That's a great question. I think in terms of the Angels have – in terms of their character and the identity, when you get to this point in the season, the teams that are here have an identity. And the Angels have a strong identity because of the loss of Nick Adenhart. He died in a car crash. He was a young pitcher, 22 years old. He had pitched an amazing game, and then he died. Their identity around rallying around his family. They envision themselves giving the World Series ring to his parents at the end of the season. That's a really powerful reason to play, and I think that makes it difficult. The Yankees, on the other hand, they have four guys that have been with the Yankees for a long time. Andy Pettit, Jorge Posada, Mariano Rivera, and Derek Jeter. Those guys have been the core of the team for a long time. They are the Yankees' identity. And then you add in CeCe Sabathia and Alex Rodriguez, and you have a really strong core. Their identity is that they're creating the new Yankees lore. So I think you have two sort of immovable forces hitting each other in the face.
So in the National League, we've got the Phillies, and they're going to be playing the other team from Los Angeles, Dodgers.
Los Angeles Dodgers, yeah.
And what are we looking for between these two teams?
Well, these two teams match up quite well as well. The Dodgers have a great bullpen, and that's where they differ. Both teams didn't play extremely well in their series, but they won in dramatic fashion. They're really clutch teams. For the Phillies, their identity is around them being the World Series champion. And they have a chip on their shoulder. They can win any game against any team. And finally, their closer is playing well. For the LA Dodgers, it's really circled around. They have a bunch of different identities and a bunch of different egos. But what happens with them is that Joe Torre, the manager, a Brooklyn-born guy who started playing baseball at the Parade Grounds out in Prospect Park, he is sort of like the guy behind the scenes, the puppet master. He said publicly that this will probably be next year will be his last season. So I think that there's a certain energy that he's bringing into this as well, saying he's putting it all on the line with guys like Manny Ramirez. I think it's going to be an interesting series.
Okay, all on the line, Ibrahim. Who's going to win the Phillies and Dodgers on Thursday?
I think Dodgers are going to take it.
And Angels and Yankees on Friday?
This is tough because I'm a fan. I'm going to go with the Yankees because, and I'll say this, the Angels have owned the Yankees in recent years. This Yankees team is a different team, and I think they're going to take the edge out, but in seven games.
Okay, thanks. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to talk about schools in New Orleans. Ever since Katrina, the schools are better than ever there. Why is that? We'll discuss it in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Two separate statistics here. Number one, charter schools outnumber traditional public schools in New Orleans. The second one is school education has having better performance than ever before, certainly since Katrina. Are those two related? We're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, Mark Garrison's here with some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. The healthcare debate will rage behind closed doors today. Senate leaders and White House officials will work to merge several different Democratic bills. The top Senate Dem wants a healthcare bill on the Senate floor by the week after next. The CDC says H1N1 or swine flu can hit otherwise healthy people hard. It's not just just those in high-risk groups. A new study shows nearly half of those hospitalized for the virus do not have an underlying medical condition. Executive pay returns to the spotlight on Capitol Hill today. Hearings are set to talk about huge bonuses for failed and then bailed out insurance firm AIG. Nearly $200 billion in taxpayer dollars have gone into the company. Fresh numbers on the economy are just out this morning. Retail sales took a nosedive, down 1.5%. That is the worst drop since December, but it wasn't as bad as forecasters feared. Falling auto sales hurt the numbers. That's as Ford issues another recall because some cruise control switches pose a fire hazard. Ford is recalling another 4.5 million vehicles for the problem. Ford's, Lincoln's, and Mercury's are affected. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
So we got a performance review from the state of Louisiana, and it appears that the schools in Louisiana are having their best performing year for at least a decade. And the Louisiana's biggest city, which is New Orleans, is especially interesting to look at because after almost all of its schools were completely destroyed in Katrina, New Orleans is now one of the first cities to have more charter schools than traditional public schools. And is it the charter schools that are improving education in New Orleans? We don't know, but we have a couple people here to help us talk about it. Benjamin Markovitz is principal of the one-year-old charter school, Psi Academy, and Luis Miran is dean of the College of Social Sciences at Loyola University in New Orleans. So good morning to both of you, first of all. Some people are calling this the charter invasion of New Orleans. So Benjamin Markovitz, you are principal of one of these charter schools. Should we be watching this this fact that there's now more charter schools than public schools there? What does that mean in New Orleans?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it means different things for different people. For families, a lot of it means that there's a menu of options for schooling for their children. And the burden and freedom to choose is on them. And, you know, the call is then to investigate which schools are the best suited for their children. I think for people like me who are running schools, it means an opportunity to create the best possible program that you can. Your hands aren't tied by budgetary restrictions. Your hands aren't tied by which teachers to hire. You can set a bar for quality and do everything you can to maintain it. So that's actually how it impacts my life the most, actually promising particular accountabilities to the state and to our families and knowing that I have to deliver on it.
You run a college prep school, right?
That's right.
Serving what grades?
Serving 9 through 12, but we just have our first two groups, which is 9 and 10.
So I am assuming that you're looking at this state performance review coming out of the state of Louisiana and saying, look, charter schools can work, right? That's how you read this?
Sure. It's exactly what I, you know, just seeing where we're coming in and having higher performance scores than the average traditional public high school in the city, actually more than three times that, and working with populations that are almost exactly the same going to those schools, you know, we're thinking that a lot of what we're doing is working and that the belief that all kids can learn in the right environment is being proven by schools like us and by quite a few others in the city.
But Luis Miran, you're the dean of the College of Social Sciences at Loyola University. I'm definitely a product of the public schools and support public schools. And one of the things we're seeing nationwide from a new report from Stanford is that 17% of charter schools nationwide show an improvement over traditional public schools. About half of them show just about the same results, and 37% of charter schools show worse results than traditional public schools.
Correct.
So what makes Louisiana and New Orleans different, that the charter schools there are having better results?
Sure. Well clearly the context is different here. Pre-Katrina, as you know, the schools were really kind of achievement-wise an abysmal failure and an eyesore for the city. Post-Katrina, I would describe the charter surge in the city as an unprecedented experiment in public education. So there are a combination of factors, and I don't think you can attribute causality to test score improvement. In fact, the same data that the state released shows that the recovery school district and schools in New Orleans continue to score at the bottom lowest, even though they've consistently improved. So it's a combination of factors, mainly infusion of federal recovery dollars, innovations that were able to be funded from those dollars, like extended school day. So So it's difficult to sort out from a research standpoint what's attributed to the charter schools as improving achievement and what's attributed to opportunities like a massive infusion of federal and foundation monies.
Are they serving the same populations? Do the charter school get more of a say? I mean, the public schools have to take the kids that are in their district. Do the charter schools have more of a say over who goes to the school?
Some of them do. It depends on whether they're selective admissions, quote-unquote, or non-selective admissions. And the schools that have seemed to have perform at the highest, those are, that are governed by the old school board, Orleans Parish School Board, are doing quite well, but those are the selective admissions. But from a research standpoint, again, you have to understand that the admissions process is not only controlled in the beginning, but there are also ways to kind of, focus attention on students who may have potential for greatest achievement. So we've had an issue with special needs kids here since Katrina, and I'm a native of New Orleans and been writing on school reform for over 20 years.
This is a parent, Sherilyn Branch. She has a child at the Benjamin Banneker Elementary, and this is her speaking on the PBS NewsHour.
Parents are seeking places for their children who may have physical handicaps, mental or emotional handicapping conditions, and they're not being accepted by charters.
So Benjamin Markovitz, principal of Sy Academy, a charter school in New Orleans, are the charter schools turning away some of the special needs kids?
Oh, gosh. I can only speak for our school, which is a recovery school district operated school, specifically non-selective. And actually, our special needs population is quite a bit higher than the district average. And we serve somewhere between, right now, about 15% and 17% of our student body has special needs, some with severe, profound special needs. So it's not the case in our school, not the principal of other schools, but I know quite a few who are dealing with the same situation wherein a lot of parents have been able to speak more specifically with the schools.
I imagine with President Obama coming there tomorrow, we're going to hear a lot more about this and other issues in New Orleans. Benjamin Markovitz, principal of Sy Academy. We also spoke with Luis Miron, dean of the College of Social Studies at Loyola University in New Orleans. Coming up. You probably recognize the melody. If you don't recognize the words, we're going to be talking about Rapper's Delight and what's important about it in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley. John Hockenberry is away for a couple more days. So the $829 billion 10-year health care plan has made it out of the Senate Finance Committee. That happened yesterday, a major victory for the Obama administration. But lots of you still have questions and concerns. So we brought back our friend David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, to answer some of them. David, take a listen to this question.
This is Tim from Woodbridge. I have very good health care. I don't have any problems with my coverage. I want to know two things. How much is this going to cost me in increases in my federal taxes, which you know they're going to go up, even though everybody says they're not? And how much is this going to cost me or my employer as far as being taxed against my health coverage?
David, how much is his premium going to go up?
Well, we don't know how much his premium is going to go up, and whether he gets taxed will depend on how pricey a health insurance plan he has and if the Senate bill passes, right? The Senate bill calls for taxing expensive health care plans above $8,000 for individuals, $21,000 for families. So that's one way somebody might get taxed. Also, if you earn more than $1 million and the House version of the bill gets passed, there will be an income surtax. That's the way the House looks to pay for this. But in general, unless you're a medical device maker, an insurer, some sort of entity in the healthcare sector, you're not supposed to see direct tax increases in this bill.
Okay, so here's another question for you.
My question is about chemical dependency and alcohol dependency treatment and whether or not those things are adequately covered within the plans that are being offered or that are being worked on.
David?
So we don't know the full parameters of the insurance plans that would be offered under the law. What will basically happen is that insurers will design those plans hoping to attract customers meeting certain requirements that the law sets out, including minimum benefits levels. What the law says, as far as I know, about substance abuse coverage is that the plans have to comply with existing law, which basically now means, as a result of the Wellstone Act passed last year, that if an insurance policy covers substance abuse, it can't cover it less or treat it differently than other health issues that it covers. But if a plan doesn't cover that to begin with, there doesn't seem to be anything in the law that would force plans to do that, although many of the plans, again, this will be private insurance, right, offered through these government marketplaces or exchanges. Those private plans may well offer those kinds of services because it will attract customers.
Okay, so one quick last one. Donald emails us, aren't the supporters of this bill worried that there's all this pressure to pass it now, but most of the reforms don't begin until 2013? They're going to have to go through two elections with nothing to show about it after making all of this fuss. David?
Yeah, they're not worried. They should be. Certainly there are advantages and disadvantages to that, right? And the Democrats are trying to compile lists of things that will kick in sooner. And there are changes that will happen much faster than all of the main provisions which kick in 2013. Some of the new regulations on the insurance market, some requirements that will help small businesses with insurance kick in a bunch sooner. But I think your questioner is right. I mean, a lot can happen between now and when most of this takes effect.
And Delmond also points out that they've said the bill pays for itself, but that's only because the projections include 10 years of revenue but only 7 years of expense.
Well, you know, again, certain of the fees kick in at different times. But yes, federal budgeting, we all know, is as much art as it is science, and it's a 10-year window. So, you know, again, if you want to quibble with the whole budget process, you can quibble with the whole budget process. Overall, the scorekeepers say, you know, this plan will reduce
future
deficits.
Okay.
There, folks, yeah.
David Herzenhorn is the congressional correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up in a few minutes, a hippie to the hoppity. It's been 30 years since Rapper's Delight hit the airwaves in mainstream America anyway, and the song is still important, not necessarily for the lyrics. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. We're also talking about your questions on the health care bill. What do you still want to know as that makes its way through the legislative branches of our government? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, Mark Garrison with a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. On that health care debate, leading Democrats will have private meetings today to try to mash up two competing Senate bills, and a new study from the CDC shows nearly half of people hospitalized due to H1N1 or swine flu had no underlying medical conditions. That means the virus can have severe effects even in those otherwise healthy. In economic news, retail sales dropped 1.5% last month. That's the biggest decline since December. Overseas, at least 8 are dead after attacks on a gold market in Baghdad. And here's an update on a story we covered recently on The Takeaway. A Russian court is rejecting a lawsuit filed by the grandson of Joseph Stalin. He sued, claiming a newspaper had defamed the former Soviet dictator. Now, staying with World War II era dictator news, a new history details the work of Benito Mussolini as a paid British agent. This was during World War I, before the Italian fascists rose to power. He made pretty good money, the equivalent of today of about $10,000 a week. Looking ahead, President Obama meets today with his national security team about Afghanistan, one of many stories we're following this morning.
To the hip, hop, the hippie to the hippie, the hip, hip, a hopper, you don't stop, rock it to the bang, bang, the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie beat.
It's been 30 years since that song, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang, hit the pop charts. It marked an enormous earthquake in pop music in the United States, and joining me now are three men who actually feel that history very much. Keith Shockley of the Bomb Squad, producer also of Public Enemy. Mm. Also, Paul Miller, most people now probably know him as DJ Spooky, and Mark Anthony Neal, professor of black popular culture at Duke University. He joins us from Duke. So first of all, let me start with you, Paul, a.k.a. DJ Spooky. You were probably about 9 or 10 when this song first came out, maybe. Tell me about when were you first aware of this song when it came out? And what do you first remember when you heard it?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and one of the things that you really have to realize is D.C. has a style called go-go, which was really influential on early hip-hop. So you had Trouble Funk, Rare Essence, a lot of bands that really, like, everybody has sampled, the Beastie Boys, BDP, and so on. But when you heard, Rapper's Delight, it just spread like a virus, you know. Forget SARS or the swine flu virus, forget it. It's just, it was one thing, just one day it didn't exist, the next day it was everywhere.
Keith, when you first heard it hitting the pop charts, I mean, imagine you were probably aware. I mean, because it was alive in a lot of black mm-hmm. radio stations and stuff before it actually crossed over onto the so-called official pop charts.
Yeah, it was mainly more so the DJs, the mobile DJs. And back then, we was mobile DJs. I was like 17, coming out 11th grade, going into the 12th grade. So, I mean, we had rap records, but when that record went to mainstream, that's when everybody went crazy because, you know, it was based off a popular record, Good Times.
So the group that actually did this song, the Sugar Hill Gang, one of their members, Wonder Mike, was telling our partner, the BBC, about how he auditioned for producer Sylvia Robinson. And here's what he had to say.
I'm sitting there thinking, damn, this could be an opportunity of a lifetime. Speak the hell up. So I said, Miss Robinson, I rap too. She said, okay, let me hear what you got. And I started going off. I said, I started talking about the dog, the books, and the library, because that's where we were.
So Paul, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, what does he's talking about how he kind of made it up on the spot, the idea for it. But what is this song actually talking about? What does it mean?
Well, at the end of the day, it's about celebrating everyday life. You know, it's about friendships. It's about having dinner at somebody's house. It's about just going down the street and watching everything around you, which is the beauty of early hip hop. And I think after the 70s, you got to remember, right, Urban Decay, you had Robert Moses, who had done the Cross Bronx Expressway and wiped out a whole bunch of neighborhoods. People didn't have a place to gather. So the social space of the park, you know, DJ Kool Herc, the outdoor sound system, like Keith was saying, the mobile DJ really set the tone for that. Life, I mean, that was just about poetry, rocking it off of anything you would see or experience. And I think that was so beautiful about it is that it's something that resonated with everybody across the whole spectrum of American culture.
Regardless of culture. So Mark Anthony Neal, you're a professor of black popular culture at Duke University. And we often talk about the Rapper's Delight as really completely game-changing in pop music. Why? What did this song do that had not been done before?
I mean, the big thing is that, and like Keith, you know, I was a New York City cat. I was a Bronx cat. I remember hearing the song for the first time on New York City's WBLS. I was 13 years old, you know, freshman in high school. And I think for us, you know, those early days, when you think about hip hop, it was something that was still very much in the street, very much still in the park. The idea of the two turntables plugged into the light posts, you know, siphoning the electricity. And it was just one day, suddenly it was on the radio. It makes this transition from a live urban art form to something that's commodified and can be bought and sold and can be circulated around the globe.
So Keith, you know, before this song came out and became popular, we were talking about hip-hop, mm-hmm. as you were talking about the mobile DJs, mm-hmm. and it was primarily heard in black neighborhoods mm-hmm. and in some Hispanic neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But here's a quote from Michael Rapaport, the actor from New York City, who's definitely not, you know, brown or black.
The release of Rapper's Delight completely changed the way I listen to music for the rest of my life. My father worked at a radio station in New York City. At the time, it was called WKTU Disco 92. I was 9 years old, and my father brought home, and I still have it, a promotional copy. I just played the record once and didn't stop playing it for God knows how many years after that, and, you know, eventually drove my father crazy.
So, Keith Shockley, you produced the Public Enemy, you're of the Bomb Squad. So how much truth is there to the fact that this song helped bridge this gap and bring hip hop over to the white radio stations?
It did a lot, mainly because, I mean, most of the lyrics on there was basically like we used to take nursery rhymes. And that's how most of the lyrics on there were, even though Big Hank's rhyme was based off of Grandmaster Caz from Cold Crush Brothers. That music, what happened was, it was so big in the streets from, like I said, from the mobile DJs. And then when commercial radio got to it, because of the simplicity and the familiarity of the nursery rhyme, like the hip, the hop, the hippie, that's almost like, you know, we used to have a rhyme like goes Jack and Jill went up the hill to have a little fun. Stupid Jill forgot a pill and now they got a son. So it used to have rhymes like that. So that's was basically how, you know, how it became. So those rhymes was basically intuitive of how of the basis of raps really got to where it was.
So Mark Anthony Neal from Duke University, how did we get from there, from the Rapper's Delight, to the rap that many people today associate with gangster rap, with very violent lyrics, with often misogynistic lyrics? How did that happen?
You know, you have to remember the stuff that folks think of as mainstream hip-hop is really a small percentage of the stuff that's being produced. It's the stuff that people obviously have consciously marketed for various reasons. You know, the kind of spectacle of black criminality, the kind of spectacle of dysfunctional black masculinity. That's big business, sex and violence and drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And there obviously were, you know, folks within the hip-hop community, you know, rap artists that were willing to provide that kind of product. But much of it, you know, still remains, you know, outside outside of the commercial realm, outside the stuff that you're going to hear on urban radio, you know, most of that stuff, you know, still is an advancement of the kind of energy and, you know, innovation that you saw in the very early days. I think we need to remember that it's much broader than the little slice of it that gets presented to us in the mainstream.
So, Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, we have a quiz for you here. I'm going to play some music for you, and I want you to see if you can recognize these artists.
I don't mean to brag, I don't mean to boast, but we're like hot butter on a breakfast toast. Rock it up, I'm in there, já vou pra letra E. Dois bola gato, meia nove, bola sete, a bola da vez.
And moving your body while you're sitting in your seat, and then damn, it starts doing the freak. I said damn,
I ride it out of your seat, then you throw your hands high in the air.
Okay, so Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, Keith Shockley of the Bomb Squad, recognize any of those voices?
Absolutely. First and foremost, that was Redman from Def Squad. If I remember correctly, that was...
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, about 1997. I was, again, you know, I was... You, there was a cover of a Brazilian pop hit that was a big cover in the 90s or early 2000s as well. That was in Portuguese. So
okay, right.
I DJ in Brazil and China.
That was Gabriello Pensador.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And that was a big hit.
Who else did you hear?
The original version. And there was
Sugar
also
Hill Gang?
One of the cover versions that came out a little bit later, if I remember correctly. It might have been Grandma.
Sound like Melly Mel.
Yeah, Melly Mel. Yeah, like
with,
a cover.
With the cover.
That was what you heard there. You're correct. It was Def Squad with Redman, then Run DMC, Gabriel O Pensador, as we said, Kool Moe Dee, and then, of course, the original version from the Sugar Hill Gang. Thanks so much for all of you for joining us. Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, Keith Shockley of the Bomb Squad and producer of Public Enemy, and also Mark Anthony Neal, professor of Black Popular Culture at Duke University. 30 years old today, the rapper's delight. Now, Paul and Keith here with me in the studio, and even though the hour's over, our conversation is not. If you guys can stick here for a second, we're going to do a video talk a little bit more about the influence of Rapper's Delight, and that's going to be up for you, our listener, on the website later. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org. Again, if you've missed anything on the program, you can get it from our podcast. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. That's also where you want to go if you want to talk back to us or react to anything you've heard. 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's where you can go to give us your health questions as well, whether they're related to rapping or not. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.